Hello, everyone. I'm Alan Minsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America, and I am absolutely thrilled to welcome you to this inaugural installment of Positively Progressive. Now, Positively Progressive is a project that has been led by and organized by Donna Smith, and Donna Smith is the chair of the PDA Advisory Board, and she is my predecessor as Executive Director of PDA. Donna's also an amazing career activist and organizer, tremendous writer, and just a great overall person. So you might be wondering, what am I doing here? Well, I'm here because one of the things we thought would be a great element of Positively Progressive, since it is a production of Progressive Democrats of America, is for me to come on at the beginning and talk a little bit about the upcoming show, but most particularly, let people know what's happening at PDA, because there is always so much happening at PDA, and everything that we do at PDA we also feel is positively progressive, because our vision at PDA is that progressive politics are about creating a positive society. Yes, America has a fraught history. Yes, America has endemic problems, but we're here now. We're here in the present. We've learned a lot about how we can organize an industrialized, technological, modern society in the world. And there are ways of doing so that can address the endemic problems of the United States, can even rectify the sins and problems that we have inherited from history. And so let's get about applying what we know to American society and build a better, stronger society for all, one grounded in it being a society of equals, civil rights for all, social justice, and economic, not just opportunity, but real prosperity readily available so that we are a broadly prosperous middle-class America. And when we achieve those things, we will be a society that I think what's happening in America over the past decades, a sense of a society adrift, will fade away and will once again be in a place where people will be excited about participating in this American project, the American experiment, and we can have and build an America that is fulfilling its tremendous promise. So yes, we are positively progressive. And as such, the one thing I really want to talk about and highlight about what's going on at PDA is in fact this very thing that you're listening to right now, which is, of course, the launching of Positively Progressive. But alas, of course, that will be achieved by moving forward in the show. And on this week's show, we have really a great dialogue, we call it an interview, but it's really just an incredible dialogue between Donna Smith and Tom Hartman. And after that, we'll have the first installment of what will be a regular part of Positively Progressive, something called The Best of the Story. And that will be coming up after the dialogue between Tom and Donna. And so with that, I am absolutely thrilled that you're here for the inaugural installment of what we believe will be a great PDA project and a great podcast that you should tell all your friends, family members, and coworkers about. Positively Progressive. Take it away, Donna Smith.
This is Donna Smith of Positively Progressive. I'm so excited to be launching this podcast with PDA's help and with Alan Minsky's help, and I'm so proud to introduce our first guest ever on this podcast, the notable and wonderful and incredible Tom Hartman is here to join me for a conversation. And we're going to talk a little bit about everything from local politics to a little bit more global view of what's going on in society. And then finally, talk a little bit about Tom's view of the world and where we are as progressives and where we are with positivity. Those of you who don't know Tom Hartman are in for a treat. Tom has done everything from run businesses, start companies, start radio stations, run radio stations, be the main broadcaster in his own radio program on Air America for years, and helped us all know a lot more about Bernie Sanders with Breakfast with Bernie for many, 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 many months. Tom Hartman is a friend of Progressive Democrats of America for many years as well. I first came to know him when Tim Carpenter introduced us in Washington, D.C. I was a guest on Tom's show several times when we talked about everything from Medicare for all to peace agreements to war agreements to everything that we could think of that was going on for progressives. I've been blessed to know this man as personal contact for a number of years, and for no particular reason, he has been good to me. And that says a lot to me about the world we live in. We had a little blip at the very beginning of this interview, so please disregard that. That was an operator's error on my part, the new podcaster. Please enjoy this interview with Tom Hartman and join us after the interview for the best of the story.
My experience, for what it's worth, has been that typically when conservatives accuse Democrats of being progressive, what they really mean are people who are concerned about the plight of Black people in the United States. It's, you know, slurring Democrats as progressives is most of the time when I see it or hear it, it's a stand-in for racial language, essentially. But I can screw them. They can call us whatever they want.
We have a young candidate running for the Aurora mayor's race out here. Aurora is the big suburb next to Denver. Mm-hmm. And oh my gosh, the poor young man. You're a socialist. And I said, just own it. Be good with it. You know, tell people that which socialist thing would you like him to take away from them?
That's probably the best way. You know, do you want to do away with the socialist public schools? Do you want to do away with the socialist fire departments? Do you want to do away with the socialist army? Do you want to do away with the socialist libraries? Do you want to do away with socialist social security or Medicare? I mean, where do you want to begin?
Yeah. I think that's the only way to really handle it. Yeah. But I had noticed that recently in our community of progressives here, there's much more sensitivity about socialism. And I hope that you're probably right about the racial issue being thrown in. And it's pretty scary for us here in Colorado right now. Yep. Oregon may be spared from some of that. I don't know. But the rift between people who say they're conservatives and people who say they are either Democrats or progressives seems deeper and wider than it's ever been.
Yeah.
And I know what you wrote today about some of the things going on, the differences between what Jared Kushner and Hunter Biden and how those various things are being handled and portrayed. Where do we go from here, Tom? Where do we go from this mess that is happening around us? What do we do?
I just find it hysterical that the Republicans are falling on their fainting couches, suggesting, actually wrongly, but nonetheless suggesting, oh my God, Hunter Biden made $5 or $10 million off his dad's name, and Jared Kushner walks away with $2 billion. I mean, $3.5 billion. The first was in 2018 when Qatar, after they barricaded the country, coughed up $1 billion to refinance his 666 Fifth Avenue building. So yeah, it is pretty funny. Pretty pathetic too.
Pathetic. And I don't know if you ever knew this, there was a party after Sicko premiered in New York City. In New York City, party very exclusive. Michael Moore and all his folks are there. And here are the people who were in the film, mm-hmm. were there, I think, just to shake hands and say howdy. Jared Kushner was there.
Yeah, well, he was a big donor to the Democratic Party
up until
Donald ran for president, because the Democratic Party, it was purely transactional. The Democratic Party runs New York State and New York City, and Kushner wanted to have political juice. His father was a big Democratic donor, too, before he went to prison. And so, give money to the Democrats, makes sense.
Yeah, I think the money, follow the money. I mean,
yeah.
maybe that's the biggest thing right now, Tom. Maybe the trying to find a way to get some of the money out of our political system. You know, Citizens United and all the things that happen that constrain us regular folks from having a say in the democratic process and really feeling like we're going to keep our country together. Are we going to keep our country together, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I don't see any scenario under which the United States breaks up. We're not as cleanly or clearly geographically divided as we were in 1861. You had literally different political and legal systems operating in the South versus the North at that time. The South, between the period of 1820 and 1860, had become, you know, a fascist state, essentially, that was ruled by about 2,000 families. And the North had become, you know, relatively speaking, for its time anyway, a functioning democracy. And, you know, the fascists decided that they couldn't tolerate a democracy to their North and rose up against it. There's certainly a fascist element in today's GOP, and there's a fascist element, you know, regionally. You know, a lot of rural dwellers would be very happy with fascism, particularly if it clamped down on the big cities. This is a dynamic that was very, very similar to the dynamic in Germany in the early 1930s. You had very cosmopolitan, you know, kind of pushing the edge folks in Berlin and, you know, the big cities, and the rural areas of Germany were extraordinarily conservative. There's a great movie about this on Netflix called El Dorado. And it's about the group that Hitler actually came after first, which was a nightclub and medical treatment center for trans people in Berlin. You know, first they came for the trans people was the literal truth. And it's an amazing movie. But you're seeing that kind of dynamic in the United States. I just don't think that the support for fascism in this country is as strong as it was in Germany in the 20s. I think in large part in the 30s. And I think that's in large part because we can now look back on that example and have learned from it.
I think that's the key thing when I read your writing, is that if we don't learn from history, then what? Do we just put our own little tag and do it again, or what do we do? And I think that's when I read your writing, sometimes I have to take a big deep breath. You know, I go, whew, yeah, Tom's right. That's what history has taught us about this. Now, what do we do together to make it not be the case that we have this happen for all of us? And, you know, in particular, healthcare is something I know you're very interested, I'm very interested in. In particular, I think right now the epidemic of mental health issues is striking to me, not only in personal experience and with family, but out in the community, the rates of teen suicide and all the what seems to be like despair in the community of healthcare givers who are morally exhausted from the last few years, and there's not enough of them. And when do we get to the point, Tom, where we give healthcare to one another, where we decide that this is the best way, the most economical way to provide healthcare for each of us? Are we going to get there before you and I die, or are we going to be gone before then?
I think so. I really do. I mean, it's in the way that national healthcare system happened in Canada was in the 1960s. Tommy Douglas was the governor of, I think governor is the title, maybe it's premier, of Saskatchewan, of, you know, one of the states, one of the provinces of Canada. And he had been an advocate all the way back to the 1920s of single-payer healthcare system. And so he was able to run for election on that platform and get it put into place in that province, in that state. And it worked really well. And, you know, over the course of the next decade or so, you know, state after state or province after province said, you know, let's do what they're doing. I think that the key to a single payer healthcare system in the United States is for one of our states, ideally a fairly large state, to adopt it. And, you know, Vermont tried to do this a decade ago. Peter Welch, in fact, was in the state Senate. I know him, sort of know him.
He's a good guy.
Yeah, he is. And he ran for governor on the platform of, I'm going to give you single payer health care. And he got elected and he did. The problem was that what he hadn't anticipated, what he didn't realize is that if you go to a single payer healthcare system, everybody has to be in, which means that everybody in the state who's on Medicare or Medicaid suddenly loses their federal Medicare and Medicaid dollars. And those dollars just no longer come into the state. And with only 600,000 people, that would have broken Vermont. The solution to this, it has to be passed by Congress. And that's why, you know, we really need to have a strong Democratic majority in the House and Senate, particularly one in the Senate that will overcome a filibuster. But the solution to this is to provide states on an as-needed basis with a waiver to that Medicare rule and Medicaid rule, so that the money, the Medicare and Medicaid money, can still come into the state, even though, I mean, the way that the law was set up, and it was set up, you know, for good reason in the first place, the Medicare law, Lyndon Johnson and Robert Ball, who wrote the bill, did not trust the southern states. I mean, Medicare was arguably the most effective racial integration program in the history of the United States. All these hospitals signed on to it because they wanted the dollars, not realizing or realizing but not thinking it would be enforced, that there was a provision in the paper that they were signing that said that they could no longer racially discriminate in their hospitals. And so, you know, in 1 year, 1967, 68, you saw American hospitals go from almost being fully segregated to being almost fully integrated. It was the most rapid integration literally in the history of America in any sector anywhere. And in terms of absolute numbers, the largest we've ever experienced. So, but they knew that, you know, these states would fight it if they possibly could. So they made this law, they constructed the law in such a way that every time DC wrote a check, it had to go to that individual in Mississippi, not to the state of Mississippi. And so that's the problem. When you pull the individuals out of the system for a single payer healthcare system, there's no provision at law to give the money to the state and pass it, you know, along. And that has to be changed.
I think Ro Khanna's working on that. I think
Ro Khanna is all about that. Well, the entire Progressive Caucus is all over that. They've had the last two legislative sessions, there has been legislation introduced to provide for those Medicare and Medicaid waivers. It's just that they've never been able to pass them.
Why can't we move it? Is it just a numbers game?
Yeah, they might have passed in the House of Representatives. I'm not sure, but because I remember the debate, I just don't remember the vote. But if it passed in the House, it got bottled up in the Senate, with a filibuster. I'm certain, though, that it passed the House. The problem is we still have, a substantial handful, 20, 30 corporate Democrats, the Josh Gottheimers of the world, who are eagerly taking large quantities of money from the healthcare industry, the health insurance industry specifically. And so they won't go along with this. And that's why we need a really substantial majority.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you knew. You probably did, I'm sure. During the Affordable Care Act debates, we did get a waiver. We got it passed. We got it through committee. Dennis Kucinich carried it through committee, and it actually passed with Republican and Democratic votes because they love the states' rights stuff. The Repubs love the states' rights. But Nancy Pelosi felt like it might be a deal killer in the final bill. So she said, no, we got to strip it out.
Yeah, it would have provoked a filibuster.
Oh, yeah. There would have been a problem. But, you know, that was now 14 years ago. It doesn't seem possible, but it's been a long time since we did that. So we got to keep pushing on it. I told you about Denver, and we're trying to do something like California did when Gavin Newsom was mayor of San Francisco. He passed a program called the Healthy San Francisco Program that tacked a tiny little percentage onto every bill for hotel or for restaurant. And then all those people who lived in the city of San Francisco had no access to care any other way through any other program were covered. It was the first universal healthcare program in a city in the country, and probably the only one now. And they got up into the 90th percentile, getting people covered. But again, that was covering this small percentage of people who didn't have access any other way, not through Medi-Cal, not through Medicare, not through insurance, not through any other way. I guess I feel I'm kind of a proponent of continuing to take, John Conyers always used to say, kick the can down the road, kick the can down the road, keep it going. And I think that matters. I think if we can get measures that move us closer, someday a tipping point, right? Maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I really do. And you know, it might be a crisis. You know, I think you could argue that we've been in a state of healthcare crisis in a big way, you know, certainly for 30 or 40 years. Or it could be the force of personality. You know, if Gavin Newsom gets elected president in 2028, or if Joe Biden gets reelected and he has a Democratic House and Senate and he has a come to Jesus moment and decides that he's going to do what Barack Obama couldn't. You know, it's hard to predict, but the fact of the matter is that we are spending literally twice as much money on healthcare as, for example, Canada, and we're not covering everybody, and Canada does, and we have a lower lifespan than Canada does, and you know, it's just, and that's true of comparing the United States to literally every other advanced democracy in the world, all the way down to Costa Rica. Costa Rica has a national healthcare system, everybody covered, very inexpensive, it works great. So it's not like, you know, proof of concept hasn't been done. Most Americans just don't know.
Another subject on healthcare that I'm so interested in, because so many of my grandkids, because of the healthcare issues around, they don't get access to great healthcare either. They get what can be afforded and what their parents provide for them. But my gosh, if we would put just a pinch more attention into preventing some of the problems that these kids are having now. We have grandkids with diabetes, for goodness sakes. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not, I always feel like it's not really their fault. You know, they're in a culture where what's available to them to eat is always not very healthy. And mm-hmm. the stuff that's expensive for their families, they don't get. They don't get a lot of fruits and vegetables and the things that might create good health. And I think the healthcare industry is culpable in letting that continue, actually, in some ways. We're a ready market, right? Americans, aren't we a ready market for them?
Yeah. It's not a wellness industry. It's a sickness industry.
Yeah, exactly. And holistic caregivers have been wanted for years to be included somehow as right. part of what we do. And they're shut out where in other countries they get to do things. I saw in your background that some of your family's from Norway, right?
Mm-hmm. My father's family.
My mother's family and from Norway. And I was lucky enough last summer, a friend took me on a cruise, never been there. And listening to the tour guide, not prompted, talk about what they give one another as a matter of course. Schooling, healthcare, their transportation is very important in Norway, very. So they, and the last thing he said to us without prompting was, we feel like we invest in each other and that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's a we society rather than a me society. We've been badly infected by the whole Ayn Rand meme.
Oof. I am telling you, it is rough stuff. So I want to add, one of the things I'd like to have you tell us, who's your hero? Who are your heroes?
Well, politically, I think probably Franklin Roosevelt is my number one political hero. He took it to them. You know, he stood up to the money changers, as it were, and did it without fear or favor, as the old saying goes. He was an amazing man. I mean, you know, some of his policies in retrospect were not, you know, as progressive as you might like. But, you know, it was the 1930s. It was just 100 years ago. So it was a very different country in many ways. But, you know, I would love to see another Franklin Roosevelt in the White House. And frankly, the thing that has impressed me about Joe Biden over the last 2 years, actually through his entire presidency, he hit the ground running, is that he seems to be taking a cue from FDR. He's the first Democrat, really in my lifetime, who was who might characterize himself as an FDR Democrat. You know, John Kennedy was trying to become a little more conservative. Lyndon Johnson, actually, Lyndon Johnson was a good FDR Democrat, although he, you know, sadly, you know, Robert McNamara lied him into the war, and then it took him 2 weeks to find out that McNamara had lied to him about the Gulf of Tonkin. But at that point, he was so far in that he couldn't pull himself out. And he just went along with the lie, which was, you know, just a terrible tragedy for LBJ's presidency. But, you know, I think that's what we need. We need leaders.
Do we have more than Biden? Do we have other people who can rise up?
I think so.
What do you see?
I think Gavin Newsom has a good shot at it. Frankly, I'm quite impressed by Gavin Newsom.
Me too.
You know, he's a competent politician, and he's definitely a very progressive person. My guess is that he will be the nominee in 2028. We'll see. You know, but that would be
really good. He's a great politician.
Yeah.
And he's been good all the way along, I think, for California and all the roles that he has taken on. Yeah. Right now, I wish that Biden would allow Kamala Harris to take a little bit stronger role. And yet I've had others from California say, no. As a woman, I feel like, hey, that's part of the reason the ticket succeeded. But it's like we don't hear much about her. You have to really follow her to know what's going on. What do you think? Should they lift her up a little more?
You know, I wrote an op-ed about this about 3 or 4 weeks ago, saying that, Kamala Harris, in all probability, is going to be our president by the end of, 6 years from now. Mm-hmm. The odds that Joe Biden will make it into his mid to late 80s as president, fully functioning, are frankly low. Mm-hmm. And that the Republicans have already started campaigning, saying, Nikki Haley just said this a couple of weeks ago. She said, you know, a vote for Joe Biden is a vote for Kamala Harris. And, you know, it's true. So I think that what they need to be doing is convincing Americans that Kamala Harris wouldn't be bad as, you know, in fact, would be a good thing in the White House. I also get it that she's a woman and she's Black, and those are two major strikes against her that are going to pull away some of the moderate, the unaffiliated swing votes, the ones that actually decide the elections, the so-called independents, and which is mostly white people. And so it's a delicate dance, you know, that they're doing, because, you know, no matter how much they try to put Joe forward and pull her back, the Republicans are going to come out and push her forward. So they might as well just embrace it. I mean, you know, it's in my opinion, but I'm not running the Democratic Party, so.
Oh, thank goodness. You wouldn't want that job, Tom.
I don't think so.
Now, you said politically your hero is FDR. I also know, are you not an ordained minister?
I was many years ago, yeah.
Do you still have faith? Do you still practice a faith?
I do. I do.
Who do you look up to in that community? Who's a thinker in the faith community that you really, really admire?
That's a tough one. The people that I think are doing like really good work are the people who are on the ground in like the United Church of Christ, which is a very progressive church. You'll recall some years ago they were running ads inviting gay people into the church. People in some of the non-mainstream churches like Unity and the Unitarians. None of those churches have a strong hierarchical system. So there are not names or figures that stand out for you. I think Pope Francis actually has within the constraints of being Catholic and being the Pope, has done a lot of really good stuff. I met Pope John Paul II.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I was kind of impressed by him, but he was still, he was not a progressive at all. I mean,
no, I don't think so.
Conservative pope. So I, you know, I'm wary of leadership in general when it comes to religion, because religion is such a, you know, in politics, you can say, okay, here's this policy or here's that policy. And religion is much more squishy. And it's so much easier for people in the religious context, in the context of organized religion, to basically create cults and exploit their flock. You know, Jesus, or actually Paul, well, no, Jesus warned about that in John at some length. So, yeah.
I always find it interesting, because those of us who identify ourselves as Democrats or progressives often don't talk much about our faith. It's a quiet thing, in part because I think we see it as kind of personal and private, and it's something that, you know, nobody else has that's guaranteed us. Nobody has the right to tell us what we believe and who we believe in and how we believe.
Yeah.
And yet the Republicans, the right wingers, seem to have grabbed this idea that they're the ones who care, you know, and it's just infuriating at times. And yet to fight it, it doesn't really work very well to fight that particular logic that they are the ones closest to God somehow.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, they're using it for political power, and that should be the tell that it's not sincere.
Yeah.
Political power or wealth. I mean, Pat Robertson died a billionaire. Franklin Graham is a multi-millionaire. You know, I have respect for people who take vows of poverty, you know, live in monasteries and nunneries. And, you know, it's, I have tremendous respect for people like that, but.
Yeah, it'd be tough.
The televangelists. I...
Finally, we got just a few more minutes, just about 3 minutes. I'd love it if you'd say which progressive victory, because, you know, I'm big on that, wanting us to celebrate when we win our wins. Which win should we put out there and really talk about and help people feel positive, not only fighting against, but fighting for? What's our win?
You mean in things that have been accomplished in the last few years?
Yeah.
Well, I think the Inflation Reduction Act and its just massively moving America away from fossil fuels and toward renewable energy is a, you know, to paraphrase Joe Biden, a BFD. I was skeptical that it could even pass in the truncated version. I mean, I remember when Bernie came out with his $5 or $6 trillion version of it.
And I got I loved his version.
Yeah. And then I got to cut down even further. But, you know, I think that's probably the big one. I mean, you know, a lot of the other things dated back to COVID, you know, the Rescue America Act, I think it was the American Rescue Plan, I believe it was called.
Yeah, I think so.
In 2021, which was great. And it did a lot of really good stuff. And, you know, it extended the child tax credits and things like that.
Big deal.
But it's all gone now, or most of it is gone.
People are hurting about that. You know, some of the Medicaid pullback has really caused trouble in some states. So,
oh yeah. In Texas, it's like, what, 1 million people have lost their health insurance.
But they really care about their kids down there. You know?
Yeah.
Sorry. Tom Hartman, you are one of my heroes, really, truly. Your thought just opens up a whole different kind of world for me politically, and helps me feel like we can do stuff together and make the world just a little better for our having been here. You are a wonderful guy, and I appreciate so much everything that you help us all know in the world of politics and in the world of life. And kudos to you and to your family, and all good to you. You are the first guest. I'm so excited and so honored and so grateful. Thank you, Tom Hartman, for everything. Well,
thank you, Donna. Thanks for inviting me to the program.
And good luck. See you soon. Well, on Positively Progressive every week, we're going to do a story segment called the best of a story. And it is fashioned after a very famous radio journalist, by no means a progressive. I don't want anybody to mistake that. But Paul Harvey used to do a very famous segment called The Rest of the Story. Well, here on Positively Progressive, we're going to do the best of the story. So this week, I'm going to tell you the first of the best of the stories. And my name is Donna Smith, and I'll be back with the best of the story. Many years ago, there was a radio journalist named Paul Harvey. And for years, Paul Harvey did a segment on his show. He did it more than 600 times. And it was called The Rest of the Story. So Paul would tease a little bit of the story, and then he'd introduce himself and say he'd be back after a commercial message for the rest of the story. It was a wonderful segment. Oftentimes, the stories ended without me being able to determine where they were going. And it was pretty uplifting most of the time. So here on Positively Progressive, we may not have reached yet the 24 million listeners that Paul Harvey had at the peak of his radio broadcasting career. But here on Positively Progressive, the best of the story is going to lap the rest of the story. So here we go with the best of the story. It was July 17, 2008. I had gone to Washington, D.C. I want to give you a flavor of what we're going to do on this program. So I'm going to start with my best of the story. I was scheduled to testify to the House Judiciary Committee on medical debt and bankruptcy. The movie Sicko had just been released. Michael Moore, the Academy Award-winning filmmaker, had made a documentary about healthcare, and my husband Larry and I were subjects in that documentary, along with many other wonderful people whose stories were chronicled there. So I had been asked to come testify about medical debt and bankruptcy, and there I was with my testimony in hand, and I was seated at the witness table. It was all kind of surreal to me, something I had maybe dreamed of all my life of doing, but never thought I'd really get the chance to do. So here I was. I didn't know the people sitting with me, the other witnesses. Some were from a Harvard study on medical debt and bankruptcy and what it was doing to people. Some were also from the other side of the argument, that there was no reason to assume that because someone had medical debt when they went bankrupt, that that was something that caused the bankruptcy. So I was already frightened. It was already a little bit humiliating to admit in front of people that I had become bankrupt. I was raised in a Midwestern, hardworking family. My mom and dad both worked. My mother worked full-time while we were growing up. She often worked overnight jobs so she could be there when we were home from school, when we were younger. And then later on, she would get daytime jobs. And also, I got a job when I was 12. I had my first job and then 15. And I was taught, you don't take a bankruptcy. That's what those older relatives do, the ones who are irresponsible, who gambled or took a chance on some foolish thing they shouldn't have done. That was for the irresponsible people, not for us. We worked and paid our debts. So here I was in a congressional hearing room, scared, looking at the portraits on the wall of the other House Judiciary chairpersons, chairmen, of course, most of them. And John Conyers came in, and I knew Mr. Conyers at least had met him in a previous visit to Congress with the whole team of people and nurses from the California Nurses Association who came down on a bus from the premiere of Sicko in New York down to Washington, D.C. But Larry and I, my husband Larry of almost half a century, we were not really featured in that first visit down there. It was more about the people, and rightfully so, who had lost loved ones to the healthcare system. So here I was, ready to start testifying. I had sent in my written testimony. I had worked on it so hard. And I got there, and the committee chairmanship had been given over temporarily to another committee woman because Mr. Conyers wanted to be more involved. And they came down and told me that it was okay, no matter how long my testimony went, because I saw 3 minutes. The first time I was seeing 3 minutes as a barrier. And I was terrified because I knew mine was nowhere near 3 minutes. It was more like 8 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. It wasn't more than that, but it was at least that. As I read my testimony and told them how terrified I was and how angry I was with all of them, that I lost my home, that I lost everything, everything to the damn healthcare system, even though I always had health insurance. I worked and stayed in jobs I hated because I had health insurance. I lost jobs I loved because I didn't have good enough health insurance and needed to seek better health insurance. And even at that, all the deductibles and the copays and the costs ate us alive, just ate us alive. We would pay all those and leave everything else to wait. Anyway, I got done speaking, or close to done speaking, and I heard a sniff. I heard the woman sitting next to me sniffing, like she was trying not to cry. And then the woman leaned over to me. She put her hand on my arm and she said, "That was the best congressional testimony I have ever heard." And I was absolutely dumbfounded. Here was a woman from Harvard University telling me that I had done the best congressional testimony she ever heard. And I was able to get my father's name in that testimony. I was able to get Michael Moore's name in there as an Eagle Scout in that testimony. But then I learned who she was and who she would be to me in the future. That woman sniffing next to me, who leaned in and gave me the courage to keep going, to not feel ashamed of myself as a bankrupt American, to stand proud that I had given the best testimony. A professor from Harvard, a professor from the law school at Harvard, had ever heard. That professor's name is Elizabeth Warren. And that, my friends, is the best of the story. And I'm Donna Smith. We'll see you next time around for Positively Progressive.
Thank you for listening to Positively Progressive, brought to you by Progressive Democrats of America. To find out more about PDA and Positively Progressive, go to pdamerica.org. And please tell your friends, family, and coworkers about Positively Progressive. I'm Alan Minsky on behalf of Donna Smith. Until next time, stay positively progressive.